Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. And of course, along with your calls, some topics to talk about. What are they, Zorba?
Yes. What is the effect of the MTV reality show, 16 and Pregnant, on birth control? Interesting data that really shows you what media can do.
Okay.
And CVS, the drugstore chain, bans cigarettes. What will that do to the smoking rate? And what kind of pressure will that put on other drugstore chains like Walgreens?
Yeah, that's gotten a lot of publicity. What's our recipe?
Cranberry pecan sweet potatoes. Delicious.
Sounds good to me. Our medical mythbuster coming up later in the hour. Our toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. And now to the phone, Zorba. We welcome a listener in Idaho Falls, Idaho. Hi.
Hi. Pleasure to speak with you.
Oh, thanks.
We love your show.
Thank you.
I was wondering, if we have an earache or an ear infection, I've been always told that if we put olive oil in a spoon, heat it up, drip it in the ear, and then, you know, put a cotton ball in it, it would heal or relieve the earache or ear infection. Mm-hmm. I've also heard that if you rub garlic on the spoon and then do the olive oil trick, then it would actually heal an ear infection. Mm-hmm. I wondered if, why, how that actually does work.
Yeah. Have you tried either one of those?
I have, and it's relieved, but I've never understood why it works.
Uh-huh, sure. Well, very interesting. Those are old folk remedies. So let's talk about ear infections. First of all, ear infections, for the most part, are viral. And in the U.S., we treat ear infections with antibiotics, and frankly, we over-treat ear infections. There is no doubt about that. Now, in Europe, they have a watch and wait. They don't treat ear infections. They say you have an ear infection. We're not going to treat it unless it doesn't get better. And there have been a number of studies now have looked at antibiotics and ear infections. And what's fascinating is 95% of them heal without anything. But if you're on antibiotics for a child, they cry for 24 hours less. In other words, there's something about the antibiotic and they actually get better. They get better quicker. When you actually poke a hole in the eardrum to see what the infector is, a lot of time it's viral and a lot of time the body gets rid of it. Now, there's an old-fashioned remedy when I was a child that my mother used. It was a bottle, I bet it cost $15 or $20, called Auralgin. A-U-R-A-L-G-I-N. They still make it. And basically, it's an oil with sort of topical stuff in it that smells good. It sort of smells like Vicks Vapor Rub. You warm it up. You put it in the ear, and the ear feels better. And that's kind of the same idea between olive oil or olive oil and garlic. You put some warmth on the eardrum, and the pain gets less. It doesn't do anything for the infection because it's on the other side of the eardrum. But it does something for the inflammation of the eardrum. It soothes it, kind of in the way a compress would soothe you, cold or warm compress with a headache or a shoulder ache or something of that nature. So, hey, if it works, I would definitely do it. And you know what? It's useful because it keeps you away from taking antibiotics. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very useful. So you've used it. Who gave you the remedy? Your mom or somebody else? Or
yeah, friend? My mom, and then my great-grandma gave it to her.
So this is
great-great-grandma.
I love it. So this is the family remedy. Absolutely continue with it. Call your mom if she's – is your mom still around?
Yeah.
So call her up. Tell her she's spot on and thank her for her advice.
That's fantastic.
You have a great day.
Oh, thank you, Zorba.
Sure.
Thanks, Mom.
Thank you so much for the call. We appreciate it. 800-462-7413.
Whenever you have a chance to call your mom and tell her she's great, always take it.
Absolutely right. 800-462-7413 to a listener now in Lebanon, Missouri. Hi.
Hello.
What's up?
Oh, I've got a challenge for Zorba. I've noticed when I get really stressed, I get a little bump or two on the arch of my foot on the insole, and it gets very painful, turns red, and eventually ruptures, get a little clear fluid, and the pain goes away. Hmm. They've given me a topical steroid, and that hasn't had any effect on it at all. I've also tried wearing socks that are 2-pair in 1. I change shoes every day. I've been on this journey for a while trying to find a resolution.
Been on the journey. I love it. Mm-hmm. I love it. Yeah. How long has it been going on for?
A couple of years.
For a couple of years. Okay. What kind of stress?
Oh, well, I've got 4 jobs and 4 toddler grandchildren that we're raising.
Oh, that's, you know something? Some people take a long time to define their stress. I think everyone who's listening to the show would say 4 jobs, 4 grandchildren you're raising, 4 times the stress that we normally have.
Is there any time in your life when you don't have those blisters?
Yes, I can go months without them.
You mean you only have stress with all of that going on every now and then?
Shockingly enough, we learn to acclimate.
Yes, well, I do understand that. But that clearly is stressful. I don't know, like Tom brings up, you know, that's always stressful. 4 jobs, 4 grandchildren,
sure.
4, you know, I mean, that means you've got really 4 times, pretty much 4 times the stress of a normal person. So do you think this is related to the jobs at all? Because, you know, often blisters, you know, when you say there's redness, it swells up, there's fluid that comes out, it sounds blistery to me, will often come with friction. On your jobs, you're standing up a lot or moving a lot? Tell me a little bit about it.
Stand, sit, walk. Usually wear either a very comfortable boot to ride a motorcycle or a tennis shoe that's kind of expensive so that I get some support.
So you've got some good shoes. Is the motorcycle at all part of it, do you think?
I don't think so because the bike I ride has plates and not pegs. If, you know, if I still had my 750 with the pegs, then I would wonder because it's always on the arch.
Okay, so let's go and look at the arch very, very specifically. So this doesn't occur all the time. It seems to occur randomly. Right. And when it first starts, do you have any inkling that it's going to start beforehand?
Just the discomfort until the little blister comes up. And the blisters aren't, like a blister that you get from a shoe that doesn't fit.
Okay,
I
want to talk a little bit about the blisters. Very small. Are they tiny little blisters, a whole bunch of little blisters that are there?
No, 1, 2, maybe 3 at a time that are really bad.
Okay. So you know it's happening before it's happening. In other words, you've got a sensation, am I correct, prior to the blisters? By a day or two. By a day or two. And the blisters last for how many days?
Oh, probably 3-4 days.
3-4 days. And then afterwards they kind of resolve. They take a couple of days to resolve. I wonder if you have shingles or herpes, a herpes infection of the foot. That's what it sounds like. Well, so I'm just herpes infection, cold sores often affect the face and other areas, but they are blisters that recur. And they recur, and there's often a tingling and a sensation prior to the blister erupting. There are a crop of blisters. If you Google herpes blisters, go to Google Images, do herpes blisters, you'll see what they look like.
And that could be the stress element.
Right. And so I wonder whether or not you have that, because if you had this on your face, on your cheek, next to your lip, first thing I would say is this may be a herpes blister. And when I mean shingles, I don't mean the traditional shingles. I really meant a similar virus to the shingles virus, which is the herpes type blister. So I've got a couple of recommendations. First of all, when the tingling starts, call your doctor and get a prescription for something called acyclovir, A-C-Y-C-L-O-V-I-R, acyclovir, 400 milligram tablets, 2 to 3 times a day, or valacyclovir. It's another drug. And what you do is when the tingling starts, take the medication for 3 to 5 days, because that's what we give when people get a cold sores, and they come out and they tend to recur, is we give them an antiviral, and then the blister may not form, and if it does, it goes away quicker. Sounds to me like that's what this is, and that's why they haven't been able to figure out. Brought on by stress, physical and mental stress, and it also happens with other things. That's what I think I would try. That's what it sounds like. Look up, as I said, Google the herpes gingivitis, and you will see what this looks like. And look at your blisters. That's what it sounds like to me. Let us know what happens.
I will. I appreciate your time, and I love the show.
Oh, great.
Thank you.
We appreciate the call. 800-462-7413. So now, Zorba, you say there's a TV program on MTV that may be cutting back? teen pregnancy in our country?
Oh, you are so out of it. Don't you watch MTV? I mean, come on. Where do you get your news? You know, Jon Stewart and The Daily Show, you know, or Colbert. I mean, MTV is where it's at. Interesting phenomena. Mm-hmm. So first of all, we know that younger people are more linked to certain social media than we are. Our social media, our friends, our family, we may read the newspaper. But as you get younger, it's Twitter, right? I mean, you don't tweet. I mean, if I tweet, it's on a very rare basis I look at it. But I hit Facebook. This is an interesting MTV show.
This is what? Its name is 16 and Pregnant.
Yeah, it's a reality
show.
And
they have kids who are
It's 16 and Pregnant. So it's about a girl, 16 and Pregnant. They talk about it. And what they did, these particular researchers looked at Google searches when the show aired on MTV. Okay, so the show airs. Yeah. They looked at Twitter, at what was going on in Twitter when the show airs, because they know when it airs. It airs on MTV.
Yeah, sure.
Then they looked at Google searches. Then they looked at the birth control rates, and they've discovered a few things. First of all, they discovered that when the show is on, that teenagers who are 16, and they tweet all the time back and forth, start tweeting things like, oh, I'm watching 16 and Pregnant. I should remember to take my birth control pill. Oh, watching 16 and Pregnant, it's the best form of birth control ever. In other words, think about it. You're sitting in a classroom. You're 16. When I was 16, health was done by the physical education teacher who hated it, right? And he would show terrible pictures of terrible things that were happening.
Yeah, to scare you away from
away. But here it is. It's a reality show. And what happens is the kids are talking back and forth. And 16 and Pregnant is a reality show. And the reality of being pregnant at 16 is not pretty. Right?
Oh, right.
It's not pretty at all. And so they have seen a reduction in birth control rates. There's been an accelerated reduction in teenage birth control rates in 2008, and they think this show is part of it.
Yeah, of course this is anecdotal. There's no
research. Well, no, it's anecdotal, but the reality is we know that communication on things such as birth control leads to education. We know that when you educate about something like birth control, you're much more likely to use it. We know that a lot of teens don't take birth control because they don't understand it, and they don't understand they can get pregnant. This is looking at an MTV show as a form of education.
Yeah. I don't want to make light of it. I mean, there's so little on television that is educational and that it can actually affect change for the better.
Absolutely.
It's really interesting.
Well, this is MTV. These kids are not going to watch PBS.
Right.
They're watching MTV. If there was a PBS 16 and Pregnant show, it would be a one-off show.
You'd watch
it. I'd watch it. That's right. That's exactly it.
We don't have to worry about
That's exactly it. Yeah. You know, go where the where the best bang for the buck is, which is basically on Twitter and Facebook and social media. This is fascinating data. And what I find fascinating about it is that we have an untapped resource for changing health education. We're in the wrong place. We're on public radio, in all seriousness.
Yeah.
We're in the newspaper.
Yeah.
We're maybe on billboard ads, but we're not on MTV showing what it's like. What they need to have is another TV show, you know, which is 16, 34, 64, and smoking.
800-462-7413. To the phones again now, Zorba. A listener in Gray, Kentucky. Hi.
Hello, Dr. Zorba. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah, how can we help?
Well, first, I'd like to give you an overview of my health. I'm 70. I weigh about 164. I don't take any medications other than a small aspirin and some vitamins. My blood pressure is usually around 128 over 74. I do yoga 5 times a week. I've stopped eating processed sugar, and all my lab work fall within the normal parameters. Here's what bothers me. For about 4 years now, when I lie down to sleep and I'm just dozing off, I experience a like two wires crossing when you get a spark.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
At times, there are flashes of light that fill my eye.
Mm-hmm.
This also happens when I'm waking up in the morning, too.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Is it disturbing?
It is, because I usually have to either listen to the radio or really breathe heavily, say my mantra in order to get through it.
Okay, so let me go with a little more data here. First of all, congratulations on being 70 and working through the miasma of health and having perfect numbers, proving also that even though you have perfect numbers, you may still have problems in life. So you go to sleep. Tell me a little, bedroom is good, covers are okay, not too hot, not too cold, bed isn't sunken in the middle?
No, just perfect.
Okay, so perfect. You go to sleep, you shut off the light. What time are we at now?
I can go to bed at 11, 10, 9.
Okay, so you're not going to bed super, super early at all. You lay down, and then how long after that do you have these light flashes?
As soon as I'm starting to doze off.
Okay, so as soon as you're in that reverie phase of when you're dozing off, do you have twitches? Are your arms moving around at all, or is it just these flashes?
No, I went to a neurologist after this. We talked about seizures. I don't have any of those.
Okay, so you've had the seizure workup and looked at. You've gone to an eye doctor at all, had your pressures checked and looked at?
I've gone to an ophthalmologist.
Good.
He said my optic nerve is great and my retina wall is
perfect. And that's exactly, by the way, the right way to look at it. You want to look at the optic nerve, the retinal wall, whether or not you've got a posterior a capsule that's pulling away or retinal detachment. So that's exactly the right thing to do. So something is happening in the reverie phase. You know, it's not a seizure. It's in the reverie phase, and some people can find the reverie phase very, very disturbing. And often when people can have nightmares, and it's going to sleep and coming back up, which is exactly where it occurs. So what I would do now is I'd look at some old-fashioned remedies to see whether or not they'll help you get to sleep. So one old-fashioned remedy is half a glass or a glass of warm milk with a little vanilla in it where you're relaxing. You take that before you go to sleep. That's one remedy. Another remedy that I'd look at would be chamomile tea or a sleepy time tea, obviously an herbal tea, that just relaxes you prior to sleep. Another one I would look at would be melatonin, and I would take probably 1 to 3 tablets of melatonin half an hour to an hour before you go to sleep because it's the induction phase at night that we can attack. The morning we would have more difficulty with. I would stay away from caffeine for 12 hours before going to sleep. See if caffeine is part of it. How much coffee do you drink or caffeinated tea?
I don't drink any coffee or tea. Well, I do drink some tea.
Okay, after 12 hours, 12 hours before sleep, no caffeine in your system. So we're talking about herbal tea. And those are the things I would look at. I would try to alter that induction phase of sleep, which is where it's coming. You've ruled out the bad stuff. You know, are these seizures? Is this an optic nerve issue or not? And so now, frankly, we want to look towards what we would call complementary ways of doing that. Also, if you go to our website, zorbapastor.org, we'll give you a link to sleep hygiene. And go to our website, look at the link for sleep hygiene. You can also find us through Facebook. And I'll just give you some information on sleep hygiene. And that would, once again, looking at the room, making sure the temperature right, all those things will allow you to induce a quicker sleep. That's what I would do. Let us know what happens, would you?
Sure. Okay. Great. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. And by the way, we'll put a link for my recipe for vanilla. If you make your own vanilla, which is awesome, and you put it in that warm milk, 1 or 2 tablespoonfuls, it's wonderful. It relaxes me when I'm stressed out and have to go to sleep at night.
I appreciate that call. You were talking about the remedies to take and going from one to the
other. Yes.
I started to almost nod. Very, very soothing.
Doze off time.
All right. Good. I hope that works. And before we take a quick break, Zorba, let's take an email question from Matt in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba, I am a rare drinker, enjoying a beer or a glass of wine a few times a month. Often, within a few minutes after I have a drink or two, I will experience a sharp pins and needles pain around my jawline near my earlobes. This is most pronounced when I drink red wine, but I've also experienced this with beer and other drinks. Do you know what might cause this? Thanks, and I love your show."
Thanks. Some questions are really enigmas. So this is a good enigma question.
Yeah.
First thing that pops into my mind is this a sulfite problem? Sulfites are in wine. And they're more common in red wine than white wine, but there are many wines. So if it's a wine issue, I'd go to the store. I'd get a sulfite-free wine. Now, there's sulfites that naturally occur with wine, but they add them to wine to preserve them. So I tried that out. That's number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, I try different beers. Some are hoppier than others, so this might be a hops issue, you know, which is somehow stimulating some strange reaction, unusual reaction in the jaw on that. Mm-hmm. And I would look at, you know, at what you're drinking. So I'd look at sulfites, and then I would look at what beers do you tolerate. It's not unusual for some people to tolerate some beers or some wines and not others, and I think this is a variation on that.
Hmm. Have a healthy living question for the good doc? Post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org or Facebook.
We have our recipe coming up. More of your calls. Another interesting topic to talk about, our medical myth buster too, here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again, 1-800-462-7413. But now, before our next call, recipe time. Zorba, this one for cranberry pecan sweet potatoes.
That's right. Do you like sweet potatoes?
I never had them as a kid, of course.
Of course. Except but on Thanksgiving.
But it's kind of an acquired taste for me, but I've grown to like them a lot.
Yeah. And it's the same for me. My mother my mother probably never looked at sweet potatoes, never made sweet potatoes.
I'm not sure my mother ever heard of sweet potatoes.
And you know, in Thanksgiving, it was sweet potatoes and marshmallows, which are not my favorite dish at all, or sweet potato pie. And then I started eating roasted sweet potatoes and discovered, you know, I'm just not giving this vegetable a chance.
Yeah.
All we are saying is give sweet potatoes.
Potatoes a chance.
That was John Lennon's other lyrics that we had. That's right. But anyway, so this is a variation on sweet potatoes. And sweet potatoes, by the way, were, during the Revolutionary times, much more popular than potatoes. They were easier to grow. They were put in the ground.
Really?
They have more calories. They were much more popular.
And then
the white potato took over because they developed new varieties that were easy to grow. And then we won't get into the Irish thing with the white potatoes.
Yeah.
But anyway, sweet potatoes were popular. So this is a pile of potatoes that you may make for a family or friends that are over, and feel free to cut the dish in half, and that'll serve less.
Okay.
Cranberry pecan sweet potatoes. Start out with 4 pounds of sweet potatoes peeled and cut into 1-inch cubes.
4 pounds of sweet potatoes peeled, cut into 1-inch cubes.
You know, and they're a little harder than a potato to cut. You know, they're firmer. They're much tougher.
Yeah.
Tougher. 2 medium onions, nice onions, cut into eighths. You might use red onions or you might use white onions, whatever you want to look at.
2 medium sweet onions cut into eighths.
Okay, 1/4 cup of butter melted, 1/4 cup of brown sugar melted, and 1/4 cup of apple juice.
Okay.
And then 1 cup of dried cranberries.
Mm-hmm. 1 cup dried cranberries.
Yeah. You know, dried cranberries are under, I think they have the tailored name Craisins. I mean, that's what a dried most of them are. But I don't know if that's a copyrighted name or not. But anyway, that's what I call them. Mm-hmm. 1/2 cup of chopped pecans.
1/2 cup chopped pecans.
Teaspoon of cinnamon.
Little tea cinnamon.
And by the way, when you buy cinnamon, cinnamon is usually pretty inexpensive. But buy it in smaller containers so it stays fresher versus a larger container. It's better. 1/4 teaspoon of nutmeg. The thing about nutmeg, and you could use a full nut. When I have nutmeg in the house, I've got the nuts. I mean, nutmeg comes from a nut.
Yeah.
Must be called the nutmeg tree. I have no idea at all. And what you do is you grate it. Don't buy powdered nutmeg. Buy the nut and grate it. And all of a sudden, the whole kitchen smells like nutmeg.
Even with 1/4 teaspoon.
It's amazing what 1/4 teaspoon will do.
Okay.
But if you like nutmeg a lot, put more in. But it's kind of an amazing spice. When it's grated, from, you know, directly,
got it.
Makes a big difference. Okay. Preheat the oven to 450 degrees. Stir together the sweet potatoes, onions, and butter. Place on a large baking sheet, which has the sides on. And I often will spray the baking sheet before I do it with some nonstick cooking spray. It makes a big difference. Bake for 30 minutes. stirring until tender. Kind of open it up and move it around every 10, 15 minutes. Now, stir the brown sugar, apple juice, dried cranberries, pecans, cinnamon, and nutmeg. And then stir, you've got that in a bowl, and you take the sweet potatoes that have just been baked, kind of stir the whole thing together, put it back in the pan, and bake it for an additional 10 to 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. So in other words, you're pre-baking the potatoes, because they take a long time to bake, and then you're finishing them off with this, and you're sort of getting rid of the moisture that's in it. It's really delicious, and it's sweet. Mm-hmm. And this serves it serves quite a few people, 16, so it's about 300 calories if you divide this into 16. Mm-hmm. If you're like me and you divide it into 8, it's going to be 600 calories. however, let's put this into perspective.
Yeah.
That's the same number of calories as the typical serving of French fries at McDonald's.
Really?
Right. Yep. And you don't think twice about, think twice about eating the fries at McDonald's. So let's put this into perspective.
Right.
It's a delicious dish. It's sweet. So you put it off to the side and then you decide. Maybe you want to make it your main dish. Nothing wrong with a 600 calorie main dish. It doesn't have a lot of protein, but it's still delicious. Yep. So
it does sound good.
That's right. Now, if you want a copy of today's recipe, come to our website. You can enter through Facebook because we are all over Facebook, or you can go to zorbapastor.org. Yep. Look at the website, pictures of Tom, great photos of Tom, fabulous photos of me. You can look at all our other recipes at zorbapastor.org. And as I said, Facebook, Google, whatever way you want to come to our website, get there, you'll like it.
1-800-462-7413, a line open for you as we take our next call, a listener in Buffalo, New York now. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call today.
Yeah, thanks for calling. How can we help?
I was diagnosed with perioral dermatitis, and I was given a Kenalog shot and antibiotic. I was also given a few prescription lotions to use, and none of them really seemed to help. And I'm still sort of suffering with it. I've tried a few over-the-counter medications. One of them is Exoderm, which seems to have made the biggest difference, actually.
Uh-huh.
But I'm wondering what your advice is in regard to over-the-counter cleansers and moisturizers that I could be using.
Oh, sure. So perioral dermatitis means a dermatitis just around the oral cavity. Where is it? Around your lips or where is it actually?
It's mostly on my chin and around my nose.
Okay, chin and nose. What do you use to wash your face now? Do you use soap?
No, right now I'm using Cetaphil, and in the morning I use a cleansing cloth.
Okay, so that's good. What if you don't wash your face?
Sometimes I don't wash my face.
I mean, our face usually doesn't get dirty unless we're digging up sweet potatoes in the garden or something like that.
I always wash my face before I go to bed because of makeup.
Uh-huh.
But in the morning, sometimes
okay, so
I can rinse it with water.
Have you changed your makeup at all?
No, I haven't.
Uh-huh. You think that's maybe part of it?
Not changing my makeup?
No, the makeup itself. Could there be something in the makeup that's allergenic? Have you gone to hypoallergenic makeup?
I'd have to look at the label, but I have been using the same makeup for quite a while.
Yeah, but sometimes we develop allergies to the makeup. And makeup is a complex product. You know, it's got perfumes in it. It's got a whole bunch of moisturizers and other things. So first thing I would look at is am I doing anything that's causing this periorbital dermatitis? If it's literally around the lips, I always think about fluoride toothpaste. Automatically say go to a non-fluoride toothpaste, something such as Sensodyne, because when we – and you still want to look at that, because when we're actually brushing our teeth, we tend to get it over our face. We touch our face, and the toothpaste has a lot of chemicals within it that a lot of people like. So first thing I would do is I'd look at your toothpaste, and I would either go to something like Sensodyne, or I'd brush my teeth with baking soda for like a week or two and see, because that'll clean your mouth. Doesn't taste very good. Back in the 60s, back in the day, we used to think that baking soda, it was so pure.
I do remember that, actually.
You remember? It was like, use baking soda. Forget it. You know, it's a communist plot or a capitalist plot that we're using toothpaste. But I would go to that and look at it because it's there are a lot of things within toothpaste that often people have allergies to. Number two, I'd look at the makeup. And if you can go without makeup for a while, I just go around without makeup for a while and just see, or I would change makeup to a hypoallergenic makeup. Go to a good store, get some good makeup that's hyperallergenic. Talk to a cosmetologist. My mother was a cosmetologist.
Oh.
Yes. So I always think about her, and she would have people would come to the store, they'd change their makeup and their rash would go away. So I'd look at that. You've used hydrocortisone cream on your face at all?
Yes.
Okay, and that has
The Exoderm has the hydrocortisone cream.
Okay, you mean over the counter? It's over the counter, right?
That's right,
okay.
Yeah.
Have you used 2.5% hydrocortisone cream on your face to try to get it under control?
No, I haven't used that.
That's a prescription medication. Call your doc, see whether or not you can get it without going in. And sometimes just giving a higher dose of hydrocortisone cream for a week or two to get it under control, and then finding out what's hitting it, which I'd look at toothpaste and makeup, and then see what happens. But sometimes that 2.5% hydrocortisone will do it. You can't buy that over the counter. And it's under the trade name Hytone, Hytone, but it's a cheap, inexpensive, you know, generic, so I'd see what happens. Do that. Call us back. Let us know.
I'll do that.
Thank you. Thanks for your call.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Yep.
You're welcome.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And Zorba, our next caller is a listener in Livingston, Montana. Hi.
Hello, Dr. Zorba and Tom. How are you today?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, I've injured my back numerous times, you know, throughout my life. I'm 60, almost 64 right now. And a couple of years ago, I hurt it bad enough where it started to go down below my waist. So I've been having some pretty major problems. And I've got 3 fused vertebrae and then 2 ruptured vertebrae below that. And just recently, I've taken 2 epidurals, and they seem to help quite a bit. And the next step with the surgeon would be to do a laminotomy. And I think he's a really good surgeon. And so I just want to know your feelings on the epidurals and, you know, what they're, what they can do for you and what you think about a laminotomy.
Before you answer, what is a laminotomy?
Well, it's laminectomy. So first of all, and it means basically what you're doing is you're taking out the disc that may be causing the problem. That's basically what it. You're not actually taking out the disc. It's called the lamina. It's the stuff around the disc that may be pushing on the nerve. Common back procedure works for some. Doesn't work for everyone by any means. Got to have a surgeon. You have to have a good surgeon, and then you have to have a good reason to do it. So do you have foot and leg pain at all, or is this just back? Or is this back?
Yes, pain? I do. It's just the sciatic thing that goes down into 4 toes.
Right. So it can be good for neuropathic pain, but when you look at a number of review articles, such as in the New England Journal of Medicine, it says it's an overused procedure. So it's useful in the right hands at the right time. In other words, knowing the surgeon and then knowing the activity and trying conservative treatment first is the way to go. And then if that fails, that's when we go to that. So you've had a couple of epidurals and they got it under control?
It helps a lot. Well, I've injured myself again after the first one.
Uh-huh.
Plus, I'm about 60 pounds overweight, so I'm sure that doesn't help.
Yeah. Well, before I would have the surgery, first of all, if the epidurals helped, you have a couple of epidurals and you can begin exercise and you can lose some weight, I would do that first. That's really the best way to treat back pain. So when we look from an exercise point of view, it's what you can do. So for some people, it's going in a swimming pool and swimming. For other people, it's a recumbent bike. For others, it may be stretching exercises. So getting some information from a physical therapist about what you can do, that's kind of step number one. Step number two, before I would have a laminectomy, is I would say, how do I get some of this weight off? And I would work on getting off some of the weight. And the reason is those may be the answers, because step number three is time. It turns out that if we do nothing with back pain, 90 to 95% of the time, it goes away. It takes a while. It might take 6 weeks or 12 weeks or 18 weeks or 24 weeks, but obviously you want it to go away naturally if you can do that before surgery. You've had the pain for how long?
About 2 years.
Okay, so you've long. But your pain, if you were to look on a scale after the epidurals, is it 25% better, 50% better, 75% better? How'd you rate it?
Probably 50% better.
50% better, sure. How long since your last epidural?
4 days.
4 days. And the one before that was, how long did
About
that one last?
3 weeks before that.
Okay, and that seemed to last for a while. I think I'd wait. The epidurals, if they get rid of the pain, then you know that nerve root is causing the problem. I'd give it some time. I wouldn't rush into the laminectomy. I think it's an okay thing to do, but first I do the other stuff, physical therapy, anti-inflammatories, lose some weight, see what happens. You're not going to do yourself any harm by waiting. As long as you're functional and you don't have a foot drop you know, and you're able to, you know, your feet are acting normally. And even with a foot drop where you don't have the foot up, often giving it some time, that disc just kind of pulls away and the body can get better. So I'd give it some time. Weight loss, exercise, try a non-surgical way first. If that fails, then I would look at the laminectomy.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, we appreciate the call, too. 800-462-7413. And before we take a quick break, Zorba, let's take an email question from Sam in Oklahoma City. He writes, Dear Dr. Zorba, I was diagnosed with a thyroid problem a couple of years ago. I've been dieting and exercising for about 6 months, and I've lost 60 pounds.
Wow.
With another 60 to go.
Wow.
A big part of my diet has been cruciferous vegetables like broccoli, cauliflower, spinach. I now hear that if one has a thyroid problem, they should avoid these vegetables, especially if eaten raw. Do I really have to give up half of my vegetable variety if I have a thyroid problem, or can I just always eat them cooked?
Oh, I think, first of all, I don't think there's any evidence that eating raw cruciferous vegetables is bad for your thyroid at all. So I think you can eat them any way you want to. And if you're worried about the effect, if you're, let's say, on supplemental thyroid, such as Synthroid, if you're worried about it, eat the vegetables and get a blood test to make sure that your thyroid is in the normal state. But I wouldn't give it up cooked or raw. You've lost weight. Keep it up.
Yeah, he says, I now hear that if one has a thyroid problem.
I now hear.
I bet that's called going to the computer.
That's right. It's the web-based anti-cruciferous vegetable society that now is putting out the propaganda that broccoli is bad.
Well, I want Zorba to dish the raw facts. Just post your question to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have another interesting topic to talk about. That's coming up next. More of your calls, too, and our medical MythBuster. All right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number, again, is 1-800-462-7413. But before we get back to the phones, not that long ago, the pharmacy CVS has stopped selling cigarettes and other smoking items. What do you think, Sarah?
I think it's great. I think it's a great idea. So it's interesting. First of all, CVS decided to ban cigarettes. Cigarettes are a major item of why people end up going into a Quick Trip type stores, you know, convenience stores.
Yeah.
Big thing. They're not going to ever get rid of them. But when you look at impulse buying, for instance, in a drugstore, and, you know, often it's an impulse buy, I'll get another package of cigarettes.
Yeah.
We look at cigarette machines. They were all over when I was a kid. They sold cigarettes in hospitals, right, in the cafeterias. They had smoking and non-smoking.
Gave them away to the military people.
Yeah, they were the military people. They gave them away to doctors, you know. More. They advertised. Yeah. You look back in the 50s, they'd show a surgeon finished with a heart surgery. So society has changed. We know it's a major toxin.
Right.
We know what it is. And I think CVS stepped up to the plate, said, we're going to get rid of it. And this puts pressure on the other drugstores to do the same thing.
Yeah. How much pressure, I wonder? I mean,
well, it all depends. If CVS sales start,
they're
going to
lose
drop,
money,
if they're
the
profit,
way.
CVS, if they're, of course they're going to lose money. Yeah. I mean, cigarettes are a high profit item. They're definitely going
to. Unless people decide to go there instead of somewhere else because of this.
Well, what do you think if you're a marketing person in CVS? Why would you drop cigarettes? Because you think it's a, because it's from your heart? Please. This is America.
Yeah.
Capitalism rules. I mean, but it may be someone higher up in CVS had a friend or a relative and died of lung
cancer.
Could be
mixed motivation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And they could say, hey, we're selling health. So we can even say now we're selling health because we don't sell cigarettes. And so, you know, we're better than the other. We shine more. I think it's definitely going to put pressure.
I saw an op-ed piece not that long ago, right after this happened, saying CVS, this is not that good a thing they're doing because they sell all this other junk that's bad for you.
Well,
candy
life,
and...
Life is imperfect. You know, life is imperfect. If I were to choose between candy and cigarettes as being worse for our society, it's cigarettes.
Yeah.
It's not candy at all. So, you know, it's not a pristine drugstore, but hey, it also brings up the topic. Gee, I can't get cigarettes at CVS. What does that mean? Maybe I should begin to think about it.
Yeah, I'm in line at the drugstore and somebody ahead of me is buying a pack of cigarettes.
Yeah.
I'm actually mad.
Yes, that's right.
That's really
takes
long.
A while. Yeah, I want the Marlboro soft pack. Don't give me the hard pack of this. We think about it, but you don't think about it when they're in line. They're asking for something else there. I think CVS has taken a major step forward. Just like we got cigarette smoking out of restaurants, we got it out of bars, we got it out of taverns, we got it out of public places. CVS is getting it out of their drugstore. Congratulations.
1-800-462-7413. Our toll free number. And Zorba, our next caller, has been waiting in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello, Zorba.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, pretty good. I'm an 8-year pancreatic cancer patient or survivor, and my question to you has to do with excessive CT scans. I've been on the regular treatments back 8 years ago here in Gunnison Health Systems in La Crosse, and then I found out about a pancreatic cancer clinical trial at Johns Hopkins.
But you're an 8-year, you've survived pancreatic cancer for 8 years.
That's correct.
Yes, so you know you're in the upper 1% probably of the
survival curve. That's what my oncologist tells me, something to that effect.
Yeah. And if I were in the upper 1% of a survivor curve, why would I want to be on a study? So what is this study going to do?
Well, the study is basically pancreatic cancer with tests and a vaccination program.
Okay, so let's look back at what benefit it is for you. That's very important. I'm head of an IRB. It's called an Institutional Review Board. We review clinical research. I've been head of our clinic IRB for 25 years. I'm very familiar with research activities. So first of all, there are benefits and risks in going in any study. So you're an 8-year survivor. If it's a survivor study where they're looking at why you survived, you know, they're doing CAT scans and other things. That's a very interesting study. That's a study I would be interested in. Would I be interested in any study that involved chemotherapy or something else if I survived for 8 years from pancreatic cancer? That'd be pretty low on my list. And the reason is, if you're out 8 years after pancreatic cancer, the theory is you don't have any pancreatic cancer right now. You know, so I'd have to have a high bar and say what benefit it is to me. Now, if it's observational, that's different because they may say, hey, we want to know why you survived and others didn't. You had surgery on this, I assume.
Yeah, the Whipple operation, chemo and radiation, all here. Then I started 8 years ago, right after the initial stuff, out at Hopkins twice a year. Semi-annually, and the purpose, as I understand it, is they are trying to develop this pancreatic cancer vaccine, which is made up of irradiated pancreatic cancer cells, so that it will be a future cure.
Sure. Oh, yeah, of course. And we're looking for cures for cancer. So have you had anything injected in you, or are you just going there?
I get 6 injections every 6 months that I'm out there.
Okay, so what's your question now? Because you're getting these injections.
My question is, they're requiring each time a CT scan and a lot of blood work, and I'm wondering if I'm getting too much radiation with 18 CT scans over this 8 years.
Sure, so let's look at that specifically. So first of all, you're now getting the injections, so you made that decision, once again, informed consent years ago. How old are you?
84.
The chances that you will get cancer from the CT scans at your age are very, very slim. Now, if you were 24, because radiation takes a long time to work, your chances of cancer would be much greater because you're going to be living for 24 or 30 years. At 84, you're not going to live 24 or 30 years.
That's sad.
I know.
Yeah, what? Don't
I
get
know,
bad
I'm shocking
news
you.
On the
that's
show.
Right. That's right. 104, 108, I don't think so. So the risk of cancer for you is actually far less. The risk of cancer as you get older is less for the CT scans. The other thing is this. If you are actually on a research study and you've committed yourself, you can always stop doing it. If you're already in it for this number of years, I think your data is very important to them. So I would continue to get the CT scans. And I'm not that concerned about the radiation risk.
Well, that's good news. I hope that I can continue. I
Yeah, I think you should.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Yep. Thanks for your call.
We appreciate that call.
You know, he brings up a lot of interesting and important points. Number one, hey, I'm a cure, okay? Number two, should I be in a research study? You look at an informed consent. You're informed so you can consent. You then take your chances. Well, he's been on this study for a while. Mm-hmm. But if I were 8 years out and then I wanted to be injected with something, that's where I would have the question. But it may be that this injection he has been making a difference, and that's what science looks at.
Interesting call.
Very interesting information coming out of it.
Let's do our medical myth buster now, Zorba. Today's myth comes to us from Karen in Denver, Colorado, who writes, "Hello, friends. I recently heard a coworker tell me that microwaving food in plastic containers can be harmful. She mentioned a link between cancer and a chemical used in plastics called BPA. So now I'm wondering, do I need to toss out the mountains of Tupperware my parents gave us for our wedding if they aren't labeled as BPA-free?"
Well, first of all, let's talk about microwaving. You only should microwave in materials that say microwave safe. So a lot of us, I'm included in that, sometimes we use plastic where it doesn't say microwave safe. Uh-huh. And I don't know what that does to you. There's some people who think that there are chemicals within the plastic that are not microwave safe that then get in the food that then can cause cancer. We don't really know, but the reality is you put it in a microwave safe plate or container, you're doing the right thing. So that's number one. Now, there are other people who say, I'm getting rid of all the plastic. Mm-hmm. I don't want anything in plastic. And so they've gone back to glass containers. So they're more – they're stricter. I guess that's the way to put it. And so if you want to be strict and go to glass, it's more inert than plastic. I'm not that concerned about BPA. I'm concerned about it if we heat a container, because I think heating the containers that are not microwave safe, that's a separate issue. But I'm not concerned about cold materials going into Tupperware, putting it in there. So I think...
So microwaving...
not safe unless it says microwave safe on the container, because then I think that's the way to go. But as for storing foods afterwards, I don't have any problem with BPA. And let me tell you, if you go to BPA, you will find a ton of websites of people who say we have to get it out and it's an issue. And I think the jury is still out on that.
Yeah, but bottom line, she should get rid of all that other plastic she's using it for a microwave.
Correct. But if she doesn't use it for a microwave, she can do it. Hey, she got all this microwave, you know, so she got all the Tupperware. Who wants to get rid of Tupperware? It's an American icon.
You have Tupperware?
Yes. Well, I have some pieces of – don't you? You
no,
don't have
Tupperware?
No. Oh, I have some name brand Tupperware we've had for 20 years with a little bottom, the top that, rather, that you put on and it seals it. Yeah. It was expensive.
Well, I guess we have some of that. have a myth you'd like Zorba to debunk? Just send it along in an email to
– Zorba@WPR.org or post it on Facebook.
Another call now, Zorba. We welcome a listener in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, guys. I have a question about popcorn. I eat a big bowl of it 4 to 6 nights a week when I'm home, and I pop it in olive oil, and I don't use any butter and very little salt, but when I pop it, I like to scorch some of the kernels because I like the taste of it, and I'm wondering if eating burnt popcorn is bad for you. I've read that eating too much charcoal-grilled foods can be linked to cancer, so that's why I'm asking, because I eat a lot of popcorn.
You really like popcorn.
I do.
Do you sit watching TV and throwing that popcorn in your mouth?
Well, I don't throw it in my mouth, but
bad terminology. I'm sorry.
I might be watching TV or reading the newspaper. It's during cocktail hour, and I have a glass of wine and a bowl of popcorn instead of crackers and cheese.
You butter it up?
No, I don't butter it, and I just use a little salt.
You can't eat popcorn without butter.
Well, I do. You have to pop it in olive oil. It gives it a nice flavor.
I'll have to try that. It's such an image. I don't think there's anything wrong with burnt popcorn at all. The issue has to do with nitrosamines when it comes to doing animal products on the grill. And there's a theoretical issue of the fact that nitrosamines may be linked to cancer. They certainly are in large amounts. I've not given up my burgers or my grilled steak or my grilled chicken or my fish teriyaki on the grill when the weather is good. But as for burnt popcorn, I don't think that's an issue at all. So you can burn all the popcorn you want to and enjoy it. And it's interesting. You bring up Tom brings up the butter issue. I have a patient of mine came in the office, and he's been losing weight. He loves popcorn, and he sprays it with nonstick butter-flavored cooking spray and then puts on seasoning. And he said that, exactly right, fewer calories, and he gets all of his all the salt and everything to stick to the kernels.
I don't know what the label says about that.
That's something else, exactly. Keep up with the olive oil. It works.
Okay.
It tastes good. So
thanks, Doctor.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much for the call. Bye-bye. And before we head out, Zorba, time again to hear from your favorite nitpickers, the Grammar Police. This week's correction comes from Marcia in St. Augustine, Florida.
You know, just one thing.
Yeah.
English is my first language. I just want to state that. I want to state that empirically. English is my first. Although I am from Chicago. And so maybe that's a bit of a...
Well, you know what? You talk a lot on this show.
Uh-huh.
And we hear every now and then from the Grammar Police.
Yeah.
How many other programs are there where there are people on that show talk, and don't allow any public correction of their grammar?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it.
I mean, all of us who talk a lot are going to make grammatical mistakes.
We welcome it. And, of course, we're public broadcasting, so we want our English to be perfect. So pickiness is okay. So, please.
Marcia writes, Zorba and Tom, remember... Ba, ba, black sheep? Well, the rhyme goes, yes, sir, three bags full, not three bagfuls.
Oh, God.
That plural applies to a teaspoonful, tablespoonful, courts martial, and mothers-in-law, etc. One pluralizes the principal word. I love to listen to your show, but I'm sorry. I still can't resist being part of the Grammar Police.
You know something? Before you know it, we're going to have to diagram our sentences and put them on the website.
Do they still do that in school?
I don't know. I'm not in school anymore.
If you think Zorba's grammar is just plain bad, just send your grievances along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org or just post it on Facebook.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at zorbapastor.org or Facebook.
And, of course, you can call us anytime, day or night, 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0222Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.